Okay, so we learn now more about what Chris Hamer's research is on.
Okay, well, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers of the workshop, Rajiv Singh especially, Warren, and Dan Hone, etc., for inviting me to take part. It's a really marvelous environment. I've learnt a huge amount and done quite a lot of work, and so I'm very grateful to them. The work I'm going to talk about was done with collaborators, Rajiv Singh, Zheng Weihong, and Jan Oitmar back at New South Wales. I'm actually a bit of a minor player in this, so I'm a rapporteur rather than a major researcher on this project. I see today's event is listed as a discussion, but I'm afraid I've sort of prepared it as a seminar or a lecture. Yes, usually this audience seems to turn it into a discussion, so that should be right. Now, Rajiv suggested I might give a little review of series techniques, so I've done that to begin with, running through connected diagram expansions, linked cluster expansions, and then specific examples, the ground state energy and the first excited state energy. And then I have notes on the J1, J2 model, its phase structure, the calculations we've done via series expansions, and in particular the question of what the nature of the intermediate phase. Now again, on the past record of this group, I'm afraid we might only get through the first half and not get to the J1, J2 model. So I'm willing to take advice as to whether I should do this in the other order. I could discuss the J1, J2 model first and do the techniques afterwards if people liked. What's that? Do it the other way around?
It's your choice.
Alright, well, I mean, most people are probably more interested in the actual model rather than the techniques, so maybe I'll do it the other way around. Especially since Rajiv isn't here. Okay. All right. Well, this may not actually take all the time, so let's see how we go. The J1, J2 model. This is one of these models we've heard a great deal about during the conference and the workshop. It's basically the spinner-half Heisenberg model on a square lattice, the anti-ferromagnet, but with competing interactions. So we have a degree of competition or frustration, if you like. So it has a J1 interaction along the bonds, and then it has a second J2 antiferromagnetic interaction across the diagonals of each plaquette, and there's then a competition between these two interactions. And okay, it's been studied before by all sorts of methods, exact diagonalization by Degotto and company, Singh and Narayan, Schultz, Zeiman, Poyle, Blanc, Linusen, the French group. It's been studied by series expansions by Gelfand, Singh and Hughes, and by our group in New South Wales, and by some others. Spin wave expansions, Chandra and Ducott, Chicato et al., Sushkov and company, no doubt others, and also by the large N expansion technique by Reed and Sashdev, by the same sort of technique as we heard about for the doped anti-ferromagnets from Subir Sachdev in the conference. Okay, now the phase diagram. We want to look at this model as a function of the ratio J2 over J1, the ratio of the diagonal to the direct bond couplings. And down here, where J2 is small, it's just like the regular Heisenberg antiferromagnet, and it has Nail order. So the bond interactions like to have antiferromagnetic order. So the spins go up, down as you go from one side to the next. Over here on the other side, so that's where J1 wins. Over on this side, the J2 interaction wins when J2 is large. And it turns out we get what's called columnar order. So here the diagonal interactions win, and they produce antiferromagnetic up-down order as we go around the diagonals, like that. Now, at first sight, you'd say that's what happens around one set of diagonals, but as you go to the next one, you'd say, well, again, it'll be up-down, up-down, but there may not necessarily be correlation between this square and the next one. So you might get a two-sublattice structure. But it turns out when you look at next-order terms, if you like, next-order perturbations, that they do get connected. And so the next square likes to be either parallel or anti-parallel with this square. And that gives you this sort of order, either in columns or rows. So you get all the spins lined up along either rows or columns. And that gives you columnar order with a fourfold degeneracy of the ground state, if I've got that right.
And that,
all right. I guess I've just taken it for granted, I'm afraid. Henley and Schender showed that. So you have to add in the J1 interaction. It's not exactly simple, right? Because J1, if you flip this one up, then you're going to satisfy the J1 interaction here, you know, it's antiferromagnetic here and here, but then it's obviously ferromagnetic there and there. So I think you have to look at the details, really, to check it out. Yeah, maybe clear.
At the vertical level, all three of the two sublattices are degenerated in it. And after that, at the first sort of level, what you have is a fourth sublattice order. And Andrea Schender have shown that there is selection of order by this order. And this is the simplest way to have the simple geometry. The axial geometry is the simplest one. And you come to this one because it satisfies J2. So you have two steps eventually in the reasoning. As Chris was saying, at the first order, classically, it's completely degenerate. So the different position of the two sublattices, right. two square lattices.
But in terms of correlation between third, fourth, and eighth sense, it's not easy.
No, it's not. You do the spin rate calculation after that.
Mm-hmm. So somehow it's columnacy because it's soft as well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. I don't know a very simple explanation. I can. All right, now, classically, you'd switch over from one to the other at 0.5. That would be the crossover point. But calculations show that, in fact, there's an intermediate phase, that there's a transition around 0.4 and another one at 0.6, and there's some sort of intermediate phase in between. And the major question has been what the nature of that intermediate phase is, sometimes called quantum disorder, but I don't know quite what that means.
Is there a roadmap that you can choose in chemistry
Well, somebody else may be able to answer that. No. Yes. Yeah.
So large end studies don't have decontamination, am I right? It's just a single critical point there.
That's probably right, yes. Because, well, large end would.
I think so too.
It would be.
Probably find the phase
that you predicted. Okay. I think probably a reader. Mm-hmm.
I think you typically
spin 1/2.
Yes, sorry, spin 1/2 all the time. Yeah. Okay, well, now the question is, what's the nature of that intermediate phase? And there are two major candidates which have been proposed. One is the so-called columnar dimer phase, so pairs of sites form dimers in a column pattern, or obviously a row pattern, but like that. And again, Reed and Slashtev from the large N expansion were the first, I think, to propose that. And most, I think I can say, of the numerical studies have supported that. On the other hand, there have been proposals that it might form a sort of plaquette, resonating plaquette valence bond phase, where on plaquettes the dimers resonate between one and the other configuration, and some of the early spin wave calculations like Chandra and Dukoff, I think, suggested that. Most of the numerical studies seem to disfavor that, but just recently in 96, Zytomierski and Ueda claimed that they did a series expansion, I think it was, of the ground state energy, and claimed that the ground state energy for this phase was lower than for that phase, so that this phase would be favoured after all. And so I guess that motivated our group to take another look at the problem. Various other sorts of order or phase have been suggested, twisted chiral order, etc. But there's no strong evidence for any of those. They've been looked at, but not favoured. So the series calculations that we undertook were of what's basically a fairly standard type by now. The first ones were actually once again done by Gelfand, Singh and Hughes, who pioneered the application of these techniques to this sort of system. And then Gelfand did another more detailed study, and then the New South Wales group has done a series of studies more recently, and as you see, I'm a somewhat minor player coming along for the ride in this last paper. So the work is mostly due to other people. Anyway, looking over all these, we've looked at four different types of series, but they're all of the same character. You set up your Hamiltonian as an unperturbed piece H naught and a perturbation lambda V, and you have a lot of freedom here, you choose your unperturbed piece appropriately for the, if you like, the phase you're looking at, and adjust and take the rest as a perturbation with an artificial parameter lambda introduced such that when you take lambda to 1, you recapture the original J1, J2 Hamiltonian, but when you set lambda to zero, then you've got just this convenient H north that you've chosen for the purpose. And you form a series in lambda for the quantities of interest, the ground state energy, the first excited state energy, dispersion relations, whatever it may be, susceptibilities. And in each case then you have to extrapolate from the unperturbed limit lambda equals zero to the physical case of interest corresponding to lambda equals one, and we do that by standard techniques forming Padé approximants or integrated differential approximants to the series as reviewed by Gutmann in Dom and Green volume 11, 13, something or other. Okay, well now, so the four different types of series expansions we've looked at are these. First of all, Ising expansions, and actually they're the same thing, as I realised looking back through those. But you pick out some direction Z and assume the system, if you like, is going to order along that direction. And you keep only the Z components of the spin Hamiltonian, the ones along that direction, and take the rest of the Hamiltonian as the perturbation term V.
I guess you can do this for arbitrary S.
You could do. No reason why not.
So this issue will happen when you increase S. Is there some point where it is needed basis here?
Right. Well, okay, that would certainly be an issue. But, you know, I think it'd be pretty limited. As you go to higher spins, the number of states grows rapidly in, you know, say by spin 2, you'd be very, very limited indeed. So you'd only be able to look at pretty small spins this way. But I suppose that's right. You could, in principle, go to higher spins. Oh yes, no, there's no way you could do that sort of thing. But then, you know, 1 over S sort of spin wave type techniques should be pretty good, you'd think there. Okay, so, yeah, so if J1 is large, if we're in that regime, then this term will win, and that will naturally give you Nail type order. Whereas if you go to large J2, so this term is dominant, the diagonal term, then the columnar type order will win and you'll get that type of phase. And so you start from this type of unperturbed state here, this type of unperturbed state in that region, and then we're interested in these two competing phases in the intermediate region, the dimer phase and the plaquette phase. So for the dimer phase, again, we sort of presume that we're going to get this dimer order, and we keep only the SI dot SJ terms corresponding to those bonds, so that the ground state will naturally be the dimer state of that type. And so, well, on each bond we have a set of four states, and the lowest one is a singlet dimer state, which then becomes our unperturbed ground state for the lattice. Whereas for the plaquette, we take H naught as consisting of all the interactions on, well, this set of plaquettes. We choose a set of plaquettes, alternating plaquettes around the lattice, and we drop all interactions between the plaquettes into the perturbation term. Well, well, that might get you very close to this picture again. So, yeah. So perhaps we can come back to that one later on. Yeah. Okay.
Can you take the gas atom state with 4 spin with the G1 Newton number on the packet?
Yes, so in this case we have a set of 16 states on the plaquette, and again the lowest one is a singlet. Well, it's the lowest one in the regions of interest turns out to be a combination of those two states, a singlet combination. Now, to do the expansion, you have to form clusters, link clusters consisting of these plaquettes. In other words, we're talking about fairly large unit cells in the link cluster expansion, so we can't go to huge orders. We only get up to about 7th or 10th order in these expansions, which is a lot less than you can do for, say, the simple Heisenberg model. Again? Or 20 something order, yeah. Okay. And then, so I'll just remind you then, this is the sort of arena we're in. We're interested in looking at quantities as a function of y, which is J2 over J1, say along this axis. Well, we're in the region around the half, we're really interested in. But we're starting from the unperturbed system at where this perturbation parameter lambda is zero, so we're starting from here, and we have to extrapolate using these approximates of various sorts to lambda equals one. And there's a certain amount of uncertainty or error, obviously, involved with that extrapolation. Yeah.
One parameter lambda. Mm-hmm. The principle of what you all put in what you call the rest of the Hamiltonian, this might be also controlled by two parameters.
Yes.
The way you write, try to reach the limit.
Yes.
In the J1 or in the J2 pieces. So
yes.
What about a day with more than one?
Well, you could do it. I mean, basically, yes, you have.
Is it better or worse? Or does it,
well, in this case, we haven't tried it. In other cases, I guess. We have to. I mean, in the perturbation term, you then have parameters lambda and y.
Yeah.
Well, in the whole Hamiltonian, you have lambda and y. So you could form the whole thing as a double series in lambda and y.
Is it advantages or disadvantages? I simply don't know whether this, in some cases, is advantages or not.
In
the way how you try to. Explain.
Yes.
Do you want to describe several critical points at once, or the
Yes.
Yeah.
It's simpler, obviously, just to use one. So that's what we have done in this case. Yeah, well, I mean, well, let me come back to this a bit later as well. Let me just say that what we've done then is take fixed y and form expansions of lambda and just extrapolate it along these lines like this. But of course you could do what you say, and for other models in the past, I guess we have tried that sort of thing. I mean, I don't think there's much. Well, okay, let me leave it there. If you can give us a good reason why we might want to do that.
Chris, let me ask one more question.
Yeah.
I don't want to slow you down too much here.
No.
But there must be some kind of trade-off. Would it make any sense to use a super plaquette, say twice as big in both directions? You might have 4,096 states or something there, and then only do third or fourth order.
Well, I think the general rule is that probably wouldn't pay off. You could think about that. But the whole point about the linked cluster expansion is the efficiency you get. You could form a series by calculating on a square lattice, say, a sort of finite lattice approach. So to get to the series to a certain order, you could calculate states and Hamilton matrix and so on a n by n lattice and then let n get larger. But you find in that case the number of states escalates so rapidly that you can only go to very small orders indeed. Whereas if you use these linked clusters consisting of small sets of bonds or whatever, you're sort of reducing the problem almost to a quasi one-dimensional problem. You're looking at lines of bonds, whatever, maybe with vertices and so on, but it's sort of quasi one-dimensional, which is much more efficient, and you can go to much higher orders. So I would say that your sort of intermediate step of working with super plaquettes would probably be less efficient on that
basis. Taking into account allowing more various shapes of chains, correlations, and so forth, then would be the case taking larger plaquettes.
Yes, so in general, you want to take the minimum size sort of unit you can in this sort of approach.
I guess the real reason to start out
Yes, that's right. You're sort of assuming that there's going to be spontaneous symmetry breaking in one fashion or another, and starting from that state. That's right. And hopefully the series will tell you if you're wrong. You know, if that's not the order that exists, then something should happen before you get to the limit lambda equals one, basically. Well, I may as well just flash this up. If you can see it, this is just a little plot of the unperturbed states on the plaquette. So these are the unperturbed plaquette states, and in the region we're interested in, which is here, then the singlet is the bottom state. Okay, well now, so now I turn to the results. This is some evidence for these for this phase structure. So this is the magnetization from the icing expansions estimated as a function of y. And so in the here we have the Nail order parameter, and okay, there are substantial error bars, but it certainly looks to be dropping towards zero at around 0.4. And over here we have the columnar order parameter, again dropping and vanishing somewhere around 0.6. And all the other numerical studies have seen similar things. And so here's the first evidence of an intermediate region where some sort of something else is going on.
It's a delicate region. Why do people like to say that the 0.4 precision might be second order? Well, the 0.6 position is definitely first order.
Right.
Am I supposed to see it also from these pictures?
No. This would say, I suppose, the order parameter is vanishing, so you might say there's a second order one here and here, would be your first guess. So then it becomes a matter of.
We don't have the accuracy to address the order.
Second?
We don't have the accuracy to address the order.
Well, not from this. See. Yeah, to find, well, in fact, we'll get to the next one. To find a first order transition, you can't do it with a single series, basically. Well, sorry, not, let me just skip to this one temporarily. This is a plot, I guess this was obtained by D-log Pade approximants. I forget about this, I just want to look at the top graph. It's an estimate of the position of the singularities in the lambda series for the magnetization M in both phases. And so you see, as we come up from lambda equals 0 towards lambda equals 1 for the magnetization, we encounter no singularity. So that says that, okay, we remain in this Nail phase as we get to lambda equals 1. And then somewhere beyond, a singularity occurs. But at, again, around 0.4, the singularity drops through lambda equals 1, and we're seeing a transition occurring. And similarly over here, there's a transition occurring somewhere around 0.6. Now this is from our latest work. This is the ground set energy as estimated from all these four different expansions. So the dotted line over here is the Ising expansion in the nail phase at small J2, and the dotted line here is the Ising from the Ising expansion in the columnar phase, and then these two lines, which are rather hard to distinguish, are the ground state energies from the dimer and the plaquette phases respectively. So the green dots are the dimer phase estimates and the blue dots are the plaquette phase estimates. And this is where you get the evidence for the order of expansion. Up here you can see what looks like a very definite crossing at an angle of the ground state energies, and that's a signal of a first order phase transition. So we suppose that this is a first order transition, whereas here the lines seem to be matching smoothly onto each other, and that's what we expect of a second order transition. So we expect that this one over here is a second order transition, well, modulo the error bars. So there's fairly substantial error bars here too. Now, so then the question is, which wins, the plaquette or the dimer? And really, on the basis of this data, you can't say. I mean, there are substantial error bars in both sets of estimates, and they essentially overlap, so you can't really say that one is preferred over the other.
So a very basic intuition. Let's imagine that the state would like to be the dimer.
Mm-hmm.
So now I can make a lenticular linear combination of dimers oriented like this, and dimers oriented like this, so it's basically like 1 over square, 2 dimers equivalent like this, plus dimers equivalent like that. And it would be precisely look like a plaquette phase. Because, you know, in the thermodynamic limit, there's no overlap between two types of spontaneously superconducting states that should be degenerate with the dimer phase itself.
But I mean, this is the usual thing, right? In the bulk, we expect that somehow or other the system will choose one, right?
Yeah, but I can always make a linear superposition of two degenerate states. Right? When you find like this and find like that, that's degenerate.
The other parameters are different.
I know, but you can always make a linear
superposition. You could, but yes, they don't talk to each other, so in a sense.
Right, but on the level of the computer calculation, I wonder if you're measuring that rigidity. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
I mean, you can take an time, I can just order like this, and order like that, and you can make one of the curves to this plus this, and it will have the same energy as this or this.
Maybe more interesting.
Yes, but
that's all there is. Could that be more complicated states than we charge?
Well, there always could be more complicated states, that's true. And I mean, I guess I'll come down to arguing that in fact these states will be a bit more complicated than they appear anyway. We've only looked at the unperturbed system, right? So that doesn't say what they sort of evolve into as the perturbation is turned on.
I agree. I mean, I like to say this is a serious point. I'm supposed to know that the symmetry is all far different, right? Do you agree that there's a state one of the curves of two plaquettes like this go to the limit where the lambda associated with the diamonds is zero, then you have the full limit to 12.3, so it's tricky. I don't know how to do it technically, but I can imagine a Hamiltonian which has really excessive diamond space. And I can make a linear combination of diamonds oriented like this and diamonds oriented like that. Can you distinguish the true symmetry gradient linear superposition in your computer calculation or in your theory of expansion calculation?
No, I mean, in principle, of course, you're right. Yes, you could do that, but I guess in nature we would certainly expect that it'll choose one, you know, by accident. And in fact, it doesn't matter because, as we're saying, for a bulk system, they don't talk to each other. So you might have a superposition, but the two states don't have anything to do with each other. The energy will be the same, sure. Yeah.
Look at pure states.
It's not sure.
It's not pure state.
It's one question.
I mean, I guess the when you would find it, the kinetic energy would be really lower than the dark energy, they would doubt that the kinetic is the same. But if the kinetic energy is the same as the dark energy, you can, you're dealing with the superficial.
Well, this certainly seems to say they're very close. I mean, that's one thing. So, which is very like the simple Heisenberg model, right? I think their estimates that the ground energy of the Plaquette RVB state and the anti-Fermilab state are only 0.1% different or something. Tiny difference in energy for the, down at zero. So this is sort of consistent with that, and we'll see evidence that in a sort of sense, they're probably mixed. The correlations are a mixture, in fact, of these. Yes, we have looked at some susceptibilities. So you might be tempted to say, okay, it looks a bit like the diameter is a bit lower here, but then, you know, up here it even looks like there's a bit of a crossover, but within the error bars you really can't see anything from here.
So you can carry either one to infinite order, you get the right answer, right?
In principle.
So that's sort of what you say?
Well, no. Okay, I would expect you'll get the right answer, but it won't be the same. It might be very close. Why should it be the same? It'd be an extraordinary action difference.
Same Hamiltonian, right?
Yeah.
Oh. No, well, no, right, sorry. Yeah, okay, I'll tell you a difference in a minute, okay? Let me come back to that. So I'm continuing the slideshow. This is from Kotov et al., one of the earlier papers. This is a picture of the gaps as a function of y, j2 over j1. This is the triplet gap estimated from the series. This is the triplet gap estimated by a diagrammatic technique, Sushkov and Kotov. And this is the singlet gap estimated by the same sort of technique. And the point is to notice that they seem to be dropping down towards zero at around this, you know, within substantial error bars, in fact, somewhere around 0.4. So again, it looks somewhat second order. It looks like gaps are vanishing, the system's becoming degenerate around 0.4. These are estimates, obviously very crude estimates, of some dimer order parameters, which I'll come back to in a bit.
But the gap is not small, right? It's 0.4.
Say again?
The gap is not small, right?
Well, in the middle, it's not small, yes. So this is a gap phase, that's right. But we're claiming it's coming down low over here. Now, this has to do with the point we were just talking about. This is a phase diagram for the Plaquette expansion. So we're expanding the, doing the Plaquette expansion, the last one. And this is an estimate of the point where the gap in that phase vanishes. So this is an estimate of where we get a transition as we go from lambda equals zero towards lambda equals one. And so over here, this is exactly what we expect, the triplet gap vanishes, and that's a signal that we're doing what we expect, we're making a transition from the Plaquette phase to the Nail phase, which is the correct phase at low J2 over J1. And over here, we have a singlet gap vanishing, which is taken as the signal that we're going from the Plaquette phase to the columnar phase over here. And now this is the interesting region in the middle, and here we have larger error bars, so you have to make a judgment as to how far you trust the error bars. But on the face of it, it says that in the intermediate region also, we've made a transition. We've gone from the plaquette phase to something else, so the plaquette phase does not persist up to lambda equals 1. Oh, sorry, lambda equals 1 is right around here, so there's a lot of ifs and buts about that statement. But there's evidence here that the plaquette phase does not persist, whereas if you do the dimer expansion, and I'm afraid I haven't got the corresponding graph here, the gap vanishes beyond, fairly close to, but beyond lambda equals 1, again with large error bars. So again, this is the major evidence, in fact, and I haven't even got half of it to show you, that the dimer phase is more stable than the plaquette phase.
How do you become critical points?
Well, just standard D-log Pareys, that sort of thing.
Okay. So you take a critical point, your series don't converge.
That's right. So, strictly speaking, you cannot continue the series beyond this critical point. So, what the series has to tell you beyond here from this expansion means nothing, if you like. But series, I mean, experience shows that for the ground state energy, which is what I showed before, you know, it continues on in a reasonable sort of fashion beyond at least a second order critical point with in rapidly increasing error bars. So this is the major evidence that the dimer phase wins. I should have said, I forgot to say, going back here, this does not agree with what Zhytomyrsky and Ueda said. Zhytomyrsky and Ueda claimed the plaquette ground state energy was lower than the dimer one in a substantial way. Well, we don't agree with that. Their expansion was to second order in lambda, and ours is to seventh order in lambda. And Zheng claims that, well, he suspects that they made an error by a factor of 2 in their second order coefficient.
Sorry, I didn't quite understand the issue with lambda Z
Yes, you're an XXC model, but an XXC model can show transitions. This is a real transition. So now we're talking about a model with two parameters, one of which we've introduced artificially, but still, lambda and y. And we're saying there is actually a transition line along here.
Where the gap vanishes.
Where the gap vanishes.
I was thinking of the XXV level. Because it's not the same as the curves, right? Sorry, yes, that's
yes.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, so, well, this is exactly that. This is a very conjectural picture of the topology that might exist in this phase diagram. So here we've got lambda versus y. This is three different topologies. We might have a plaquette phase here, nail phase here, columnar phase here, and then perhaps we might make a transition to a dimer phase in this intermediate region, separated by a line like this, or perhaps a line like that, or perhaps a tricritical point like this. And this is just conjecture. We don't know. We have no evidence one way or the other. But it might be interesting, I mean, just on theoretical grounds, to study that diagram more closely. Yeah, so this is, I guess, for the plaquette expansion. The yeah.
How would I have to see to understand the order of this transition?
Well, we don't have much information, but we have some suspicion that this one is second order, so you might think this is going to be a second order line. This one we think is first order, so this will be a first order line. The rest, okay, I don't know. I'd have to guess as I stand here. Well, if the gap vanishes, then these might be second order. but you don't know whether a first order might not intervene beforehand or something.
I guess a second order precision is very remarkable, right? In an entry into a blend asymmetry patch, you would expect all these decisions to be first order because you break different symmetries. Right?
Okay.
I guess it's a research that has hand waving and that's a beautiful theoretical consideration to argue that the Yale ordered two Dimer precision can be second order, where the translational symmetry wave of the Dimer phase is a dangerously irrelevant operator.
Right.
It's not a precision, but there's no generic behavior. So wouldn't you expect all the lines of first order except for special stuff associated with the Yale ordered two?
All right. Could be. I mean, I think there's a lot of room for more work on this, you know, because the nature of the transition has been barely touched, I'd say. You know, it's not very easy to do, mind you, but it would be interesting if one could find out more about it. I'm just taking the naive view that if you reach a point where the gap vanishes, then that's usually a signal of a second order transition of some sort. But of course.
Yes.
Yes.
And that speed would be into it.
Well. Okay. Well, it'd be interesting to examine the arguments as well. Other than that, I've just got some bits and pieces. Some other evidence, which just reinforces the picture a bit. I already said the Dimer series expansions don't show any singularities, or at least any prominent singularities. That's not true. I've just said something incorrect. But for the Dimer series, what you get is a transition point arise from the Dimer phase, say the Nail phase, and the columnar phase, but it looks like the transitions, there's no transition in the middle region before you get to lambda equals 1 within substantial error bars. Another piece of evidence, the anti-ferromagnetic susceptibility, well, actually this is nothing new, for the Plaquette expansion over here, as you go up this way, the anti-ferromagnetic susceptibility diverges as you reach this point, which indicates again that you're unstable to Nail order. Yes, that's another. You know, looks second order again, but you know, a first order one might come in beforehand. You don't know because you're only expanding from one side, so it can always be that a first order transition happens first, as it were. When you look at the Dimer phase, the susceptibility to Plaquette excitations, you can formulate somewhere down here an operator that looks like Plaquette order, gets large as you go towards lambda equals 1, but we claim doesn't diverge to infinity, which means that the Dimer phase is becoming somewhat less stable to Plaquette-type excitation. And that perhaps is reasonable. You can easily see that these bond dimers here could easily switch around and form that sort of pattern. So it looks like that would be a very reasonable thing to expect, that you'll get some resonance within the columns of the dimers. And the Dimer order parameters, which I had before, are also supposed to give sort of weak evidence of that sort. This is Kotev et al. Calculated two different Dimer order parameters. One was the expectation value of one bond minus, this is dx, this singlet expectation value minus that single expectation value, I think. And that's fairly large, showing that we tend to alternate along the columns. Whereas dy is this singlet expectation value minus this expectation value, and that's quite a bit smaller. And that shows that the difference between this bond and this bond is not so great. In other words, again, it looks like there's resonance between the horizontal and vertical bonds within a column to some extent. I mean, okay, there's the rather crude evidence. So, just to summarise then, the conclusions we reach are sort of the conventional ones, that the phase structures, we have a nail phase over here up to 0.4, we have a columnar phase beyond 0.6, and we certainly seem to prefer the columnar dimer phase in the middle. It looks like this might be second order, perhaps in the O3 universality class, has been speculated here and there. This one looks first order. The evidence does favour this phase, but with these strong resonances within the columns, which sort of mixes, if you like, the plaquette character into this columnar dimer phase. And this does appear to support the Reed and Sashtev picture of basically this columnar dimer looks like a striped phase for this system along the columns. Yeah.
Regarding the exact annotation, if the true columnar dimer would be realized, would I expect to see a four-fold degenerate ground state in an analysis?
Yes, that's right. Well, there's some. Yes. There's some slight evidence of that. Yes. People have done. Claire might know better than I, because I didn't manage to find the latest French reference. I know that if. Yeah. I know that. Our group has actually looked at 4x4, and the first three excitations are three singlets, which is sort of consistent with the idea that they'll come down and become degenerate in the bulk limit. No, they're not degenerate, but the first three are singlets. Now, I don't know what's happened in 6x6, and I'm not. Well. I saw a reference in the French journal, which unfortunately isn't in the library, as far as I can tell. But anyway, that would be a good thing to look at, yeah. Look for this four-fold degeneracy. It would be a strong confirmation. Would it? How does that work? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Hold on. For once we've finished on time, but I've had to cut half my talk.
More than 50 minutes. Could you say something about the methods in, say, 15 minutes?
All right, I can give you a flying tour, if you like. So this is on the actual series methods. What I can do is gallop through, and you can stop me when I reach a point. It might be of interest, because a lot of it is fairly standard and has been known for a long time, so I can probably go pretty rapidly. Well, I probably should skip over this, but I did plan to say, first of all, we have various numerical methods, and all of them have a different role to play and all have limitations. Exact idealization, which Claire has told us about, very precise, gives us an exact picture, but only of a small system. So you have to do some sort of finite size scaling if you want to extrapolate to the bulk. Quantum Monte Carlo, extremely powerful, very crude, but basically only works for sort of simple systems. If you've got fermions or frustration or what have you, then Monte Carlo largely breaks down. DMRG, a rapidly rising technique, but still mainly limited to one-dimensional, quasi-one-dimensional systems. And so we're left with series, which has advantages, gives you results directly for the bulk system, can deal with fermions or frustrated systems, and is not limited to low dimensions, but does have disadvantages. We have to do this extrapolation in the coupling, which introduces uncertainty, and in general we cannot continue past the phase transition. Well, this I can go faster. Okay, we're talking about, I didn't say in the beginning, expansions for zero temperature systems, looking at the energies of the different states. In some parameter lambda, we have an unperturbed H naught and a perturbation V. We've all learnt in high school how to do Rayleigh-Schrodinger-type perturbation theory for such a system. The next step is typically to formulate the expansion in terms of connected diagrams, and this you can do in virtually every field of physics. In this sort of system, it goes back to Bruckner and Goldstone, etc., probably much further back even than that. There is a little snag in that you've got to take care of what are called overlap terms in these lattice models, which I won't go into at all, but only say that for a quantity like the ground state energy, which is extensive, you can always express it in terms of connected diagrams if you formulate the rules correctly. And, well, for a transverse icing model, you can draw little box-like diagrams like this, which give you the ground state energy. I won't even bother to explain what these mean. But the main point is the most efficient way to do it is via these link clusters, because you can get the, if you like, you get the series up to a certain order from the minimum size mass lattice possible, the set of clusters with the smallest possible size. Now, in this context, as far as I know, this goes back to some unpublished notes of Nickel in about 1980. And Michael Barber came back for a visit and gave me some photocopied notes from Nickel, which I must admit I tossed into a drawer. Didn't look at for a couple of years, but later pulled them out when Alan Irving from Liverpool was visiting and we realised there was something there and began to use them in about 83, 84, something like that. Nickel himself, I'm not aware that he ever published anything on this, but his student Marland wrote one or two papers in about 1981 using the technique. And we used it for a number of years, and this is a little review in about 1990 we wrote. But we didn't advertise ourselves very well, and Gelfand, Singh and Hughes rediscovered the whole business in about 1988. And they wrote a review in 1990 also. So in fact the technique wasn't new, but the use they made of it was new. They sort of showed how to use it in a sort of imaginative fashion to deal with more complicated systems, in particular degenerate systems, which we hadn't been able to tackle, such as the Heisenberg model and all its relatives. Anyway, the basic idea here is in these two equations, it's very, very simple, you can express the Okay, this is the ground state energy on a bulk system of n sites where n is going from infinity. You can express this as a sum of terms where epsilon alpha is, if you like, the cumulant energy, the cumulant energy for cluster alpha, and a cluster is a set of sites or bonds like this. And the way I like to think of it is that it's the sum of all the connected diagrams that span that cluster, that span the entire cluster. And so this is just breaking up all the connected diagrams that contribute to the ground state energy into sets corresponding to the clusters that they live on, if you like. And each of those contributions has to be multiplied by the number of ways that you can embed that cluster alpha in the bulk lattice N. And similarly, for a given cluster alpha, you can express its ground state energy as a sum over the contributions of all the subclusters that can be embedded in that cluster alpha. And each subcluster contributes an epsilon beta, and C alpha beta tells you the number of ways that you can put beta into alpha. So for instance, if this is alpha, then it has subclusters like this, and this can go into that in two ways, as you can see at a glance. I will show you. The algorithm then is basically simple. First of all, you have to generate a list of clusters, linked clusters, and their embedding constants and lattice constants, which is a well-known geometrical problem. You'll find it in Dohmann Green Volume 3. Instructions how to do that, but I note that Hartmut Molin and Simon Trebst have got a new way of doing that, which sounds extremely efficient. I'll be interested to find out more about that. Once you've done that, then for each cluster alpha, you've got to calculate its ground state energy, which is your basic Schrodinger problem on the cluster. I just note Hornby and Barber discussed efficient ways to do that. And then once you've done that, you can go back to, in particular, this equation. Once you've got the cluster energies alpha, E naught alpha, you can derive the cumulative energies epsilon just by combinatorics. So for this cluster, they're the same thing. For this one, you take the energy minus the two epsilons of that, and you've got that one's cumulative energy, and you build yourself up. And so by that means you can get the ground state energy and everything you can get from it, namely its derivatives, such as the magnetization, the susceptibility, in fact expectation values via the Feynman-Hellman theorem, and principle you can get, all sorts of things you can generate. Well, that's all old hat, but the more interesting thing is the excited states, which are harder to deal with. We did have, in previous times, a way of getting the excited state, but it was a very clumsy method, an ugly method, which involved disconnected clusters as well as connected ones. Martin Gelfand in 1996 showed how to do it much more neatly and elegantly, and furthermore how to calculate dispersion relations, etc., properties of excited states, at least one particle type excited state. So here I'm considering, say, maybe we have a flipped spin in a ferromagnet or something corresponds to an excited state. How do we get its energy? How am I doing? So if we can just spend 5 minutes more on this. Okay, well, Gelfand's prescription is as follows. First of all, again, you look at a single cluster of L sites. We look at the Hamiltonian now in the one particle sector, which is often disjoint from the vacuum sector. And the Hamiltonian then will be a matrix where we can break it up into blocks, where in the top left corner we have the we have the basis of the L1 particle states, or the one spin states, and then the rest corresponds to the other states, higher excited states. The prescription is to form an effective Hamiltonian by applying a similarity transformation which converts the diagonal blocks between the one particle sector and the higher excited states to zero. And that's a standard sort of exercise in, you know, numerical methods. It's a sort of Gibbons householder type transformation. Basically what you're doing is integrating out these higher degrees of freedom and forming an effective Hamiltonian simply within the one particle sector, which should in some fashion give you the energies of the one particle states. And Gelfand does it order by order, so the prescription is to do it order by order in perturbation theory rather than all together in one hit. Well, that gives you, as I say, an effective Hamiltonian for the L initial one particle states expressed as a series of lambda. But now, we want to do a linked cluster expansion like we did for the Gramsci energy, and that's the tricky bit. We need to find a quantity that obeys the basic cluster property that for a disconnected cluster C consisting of two parts A and B which are separated in space, the quantity should obey simply the overall Q of C should be simply the sum of QA and QB, which certainly the ground state energy obeys, and in fact that implies then it's going to be an extensive quantity. Well, the single particle energy is not extensive, okay? It consists of the ground state energy plus a piece, plus a gap for the single particle. And that already gives you a clue what you need to do. To find a quantity, well, basically you find that this is the quantity with the cluster property. So you've got to form that object there. And, well, the argument goes like this. Let's suppose we have a disconnected cluster. Apply the effective Hamiltonian to it. Then you have two cases. If the one particle initial and final states that you're interested in belong to cluster A, then the Hamiltonian applied to this system will give you the one particle energy for cluster A plus the zero particle, that is the vacuum energy, for cluster B. And in terms of our effective Hamiltonian matrix, that will be multiplied by the unit matrix because it doesn't affect the one particle states over here. Alternatively, the one particle initial and final states might be connected to cluster B, in which case we'll get the one particle term for cluster B plus the vacuum energy for cluster A. And the overall matrix is a direct product, a direct sum, sorry, of those two possibilities. Well, you look at this and it does not, certainly does not obey this cluster property. However, if we subtract the vacuum energy from both sides, in other words, we take this and we subtract the vacuum energy for total cluster C times the unit matrix, then in this case, EC is simply EA plus EB. So for this case, we just get H effective for A minus the vacuum energy for A. In this case, we get H effective for B, the one particle, minus E sub B. And then you see this matches that and that. And in fact, we do have the cluster property now. So we can form a linked cluster expansion for this overall property, which is basically this, well, it's related to the gap. It's related to the gap. What we're really forming is a cluster expansion for this object, where we start from a given initial site I and finish in a given initial site J. And if you Fourier transform, you can form results for the energy as a function of Q. You get a dispersion relation for the first excited state energy.
How does delta depend on
n? Well, delta is going to be a gap then, right, sorry.
N to the zero.
N to the zero, right. So that is, this is a minor point, that's not extensive then, right? But because we're summing over initial sites, we're really getting n times that gap in a sense. So, yeah. Okay. I've lost my final thing, but so this is how you deal with the gap. This gives you the dispersion relation, etc. And the question that Rajiv raised last week, or maybe before, was, what about higher states? Higher states haven't actually been done. So the generalization actually remains to be done. Okay, thanks, Ron.
Is it possible to share this for recording and you've got a cover of the one at the moment?
What was the first one? Anyway, Hubbard, yes, it is possible. As I say, they're difficult because a priori they're degenerate systems, and doing degenerate perturbation theory is basically not on, you know. It's very, very difficult. But Rajiv Singh and company have shown there are clever ways, just by choosing a piece of the Hamiltonian, you can start from a point which is not degenerate, and then put in some artificial parameter lambda, where in the limit you regain the degeneracy in the system you want. But hopefully the results apply. So in fact, they have, Singh and company have done Hubbard, and he and we have also done TJ. So you start from some sort of icing-like or dimer-like or some sort of convenient.
A good starting point.
Yes, that's right. So you have to choose an appropriate starting point. That's the trick.
Right, but I mean the perturbation must be extremely singular in it because you're going to a degenerate state again.
Yes.
So
obviously you want to choose a point corresponding to the order you expect in the limit. So for the Heisenberg, okay, then we're talking massless excitations, magnons in the bulk system, so that's basically degenerate. But we choose an icing type expansion which gives you the order that you will expect will in fact exist, the Nail order that will exist when you go to the isotropic limit. And if you choose an appropriate starting point like that, then you should hopefully get reasonable results. But yes, there are singularities. I mean, that's another point. Singh et al. Showed, well, spin wave theory tells you you expect square root type singularities as you go to the isotropic limit. So you have to account for those in the analysis.
The large error bar when you increase lambda, what is the source of the large error bar?
Okay, well, I didn't show at all the extrapolation, but the... And this is an area that could also use some work, but... basically, you take some quantity and you extrapolate in lambda, and you form these approximants, Pades or integrated differential, and you get some curve, and you do a different order approximate, and you get another curve. And basically, you sort of get a spray of different curves, and you throw away typically a couple that are completely defective, have some spurious singularity in them, and then you sort of take an estimate like that. That's where your error bars come from.
You extrapolate different approximation, different second order.
Well, you can form a Pade, say a second order Pade requires 5 series coefficients, a 2-2 Pade, and then you can form a 3-3 Pade out of 7 coefficients. Well,
the order of the polynomial is the denominator and the numerator.
Yes, you're approximating the same thing.
So the question is how well captures the Faraday, the asymptotic expansion which you have and it's
So it's a very phenomenological sort of rule of thumb type position.
Because would you not expect that the higher Faraday further you get the right answer and then
the
best one would be the highest Faraday and the
Well, yes, you certainly look for better convergence as you increase the order of the Faraday answer. And yes, so typically you'd only keep the higher order ones, I suppose. You'd throw away most of the lower order ones. But I must say, often you find you'll reach a certain point, well, say in lattice gauge theories, for instance, where you've got complicated singularities. You'll typically reach a certain point and it'll be very hard to go much further. You know, the convergence will only improve a little as you go to higher orders beyond there. Well, basis in lambda. Yeah, so often we form Okay, the Pade technique, right, is to approximate the function by a ratio of two polynomials of order n and m in lambda, and you match the coefficients up to a certain order exactly. So if you know this to fifth order, you can get that to, say, third and that to third with a normalization. Sorry? Yeah, so this is the order. So you want these as high as...
Yeah, but I mean, there's one point to say also. I mean, if you know, I mean, what kind of phase transition you are getting, I mean, then you know, I mean, the exponent, or you can estimate the exponent, and then you could do, you know, a log of this thing, and then you can approximate basically, I mean, the singularities in a much better way. So, I mean,
yes,
there are two points where physics comes in. I mean, one point is the starting point where you start your series expansion, and the other point is, you know, the extrapolation. And if you know a little bit about the
physics, you just cut off singularity and then everything.
Yeah, so if you know this function is going to constant, for instance, then you'll approximate it by some function which also goes to a constant as lambda goes to infinity or one. Yeah, so you have to use every trick you can, you know, to get good results. That's for sure. If there was some magic way of doing it, you know, that didn't require prior knowledge, we would use it. But
This is also maybe an answer to your question. You were saying, hey, why not doing it?
It's a matter of analyzing about convergence.
Right. I mean, there's one point, I mean, it's costly if you have two parameters. I mean, because you explicitly have that tension between more coefficients. And so that, you know, just the Hilbert space is distinguishing between the expansion. And so, you know, you want to go as far as possible in the order, and so it's better to restrict oneself to one parameter.
Yes, it's just easier, I suppose. I mean, if you wanted to sort of continue in some funny angle or you know, in a different direction, then you might use a double series. But in this case, we're really only concerned with getting to lambda equals 1, so we perform our series in that variable, I guess.
How do you obtain the critical lambda? Because you have not any error bounds of critical lambda, so there is something else.
No, I did have some error bounds, didn't I?
Also on the critical lambda.
Yes. Well, it wasn't terribly... I mean, yeah, often, you know, if a gap vanishes fairly abruptly, then you can usually estimate the position fairly precisely.
So the difference of your two is that the graph.
Well, no, I'll never be able to find this. So that was the ground state. Well, okay, I can't find it. I'll show you later, but there certainly were error bars. They're our best estimates. The error bars... See, the point is, say, the Plaquette expansion. You'd expect substantial error bars here because we've already gone beyond what we think the critical point is. So we're extrapolating into the wrong phase. So, and usually things begin to splay out once you do that. And in fact, it's not strictly reliable. You can't.
The largest you are, you know, the order parameter.
Yes. No, that's right. That's right. The energies, ground state energy, and in fact the gap are the most accurate sort of things you can get. Usually, I mean, the magnetization we had some pretty huge error bars on, you know.
Nevertheless, the overall behavior was relatively smooth.
Yes.
And I think that any other model could not give better results.
Well, maybe not. But obviously, these errors are correlated, right? I mean, you know, you get a point up here, the next one will be related to it. So they're not random error bars. Well, I don't think they're entirely random, no. They're correlated. Yes, they're more systematic, that's right.
Very interesting trip. You are leaving?
Yes, actually, I'm off at the end of the week. That's right. Yes.
I can't really say
Yes. Sure. Yep. I'll try and put them back in order.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
In fact, when we were...
Second?
We were saying, I was thinking that it might also be used in order to try to figure out a D-energy, a two-dimensional D-energy calculation. This week, I have not understood that the way you have to fix to... extract excited states and extract your disconnected cluster in BNC seems rather, it seems rather brainy and interesting.
Yes, of course, it's pure concept. That's right, it is rather. But why,
because
you're thinking of doing DMRG for clusters?
At the present, I'm two-dimensional DMRG. There is a problem on the way you are trying to, let us say, prune the spectrum of excited state.
Yes.
And by looking at the way you do, perhaps we might have some insight, because in such in
some sense,
what you are doing is the local.
Yes,
you are the local.